It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Donvan, and welcome to Intelligence Squared and to a debate that is prompted by the end of an era that we have just witnessed, and that is the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, whose personal popularity during her lifetime certainly bolstered the standing of the institution that she represented for a record 70 years, and that is the British monarchy itself. She certainly helped to hold it up.
I think it was important to be there. I know that maybe sounds a bit daft and old-fashioned, but if it is, it's 350,000. We're feeling the same way. And just wanted to say thank you for all the service, really.
The opinion I get is how out of touch and out of time this is. Yes, it is tradition, but in fact, I think it just highlights that this is like a fairy tale. It's like a scene out of a Disney movie.
But now that she is gone, what of the institution itself? What purpose does it serve for the British people? And how is that purpose defined? And if it does not serve the people, which is the position that America's founding fathers took when they declared independence, how should we imagine a Britain without a monarch and a monarchy? What would that be like? What would the implications be? So, long live the British monarchy? Yes or no? That's what we're debating. Our two guests are Graham Smith, who leads the group Republic, and Philip Blond, who is director of the Res Publica think tank. And though their organizations have nearly identical names, these two British writers and thinkers will be answering our question from opposite sides. Graham and Philip, thanks so much for joining us on Intelligence Squared.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
So just so we know which side of the argument each of you will be coming from, I want to go first to you, Graham. And as I voice this sentiment again, long live the British monarchy, do you say yes or no to that sentiment?
No, very simply because it's wrong in principle, wrong in practice, and bad for Britain's politics.
Okay, thank you. So that tells us, Philip, which side you're going to be on. This is a binary situation, but just for the record, again, long live the British monarchy. Are you yes or no?
Oh, a strong yes, because it's right in principle and better in practice.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Now we know which sides you're coming from on this argument. But Graham, I want to go back to you first to give you a few minutes. Since you're taking the no side, which is actually more disruptive to the status quo, let's have you go first and tell us, why are you a no on the question?
Well, I mean, it's wrong in principle because we are Democrats. We believe in equality, the rule of law, accountability, and so on. It is quite obviously undemocratic to allow someone to inherit public office, which is what this is. I mean, the king is our head of state. That is a part of our constitution, and it is an affront to democratic values to allow someone to inherit that. And all of the assumptions that underpin that inheritance, such as certain people being born into higher status than the rest of us. It's wrong in practice. And what I mean by that is the institution itself is not fit for purpose. In the UK, we have a formalized set of standards for those in public life, and the monarchy falls well short on all of those standards, such as accountability, transparency, and so on. It is highly secretive. It's been compared unfavorably to the CIA, for example, for being overly secretive. And it is true to say that the royals routinely misuse public money, i.e. spending it on themselves, and doing so in a way that would get politicians into an awful lot of trouble. Not to speak of the well-documented interference and influence peddled by Prince Charles, now King Charles, who has seen no problem with trying to sway public policy behind closed doors and without any chance of the public knowing what influence he is having. It's bad for our constitution because it leaves us with one of the most powerful governments in the democratic world as far as domestic policy is concerned. The crown and the structures around it, centralized power in Downing Street. We have a weak parliament in the face of government for most of the time. We have a head of state who is largely absent constitutionally, cannot do anything to protect the constitution or to serve the people in any meaningful way. Constitutionally, the Queen and now the King will only do what they are told by the Prime Minister. And we've seen that many times over the last few years. So it leaves our politics and our constitution in a pretty poor state. It doesn't live up to the standards that we ought to expect from public figures, and it gives us no real mechanism for properly challenging them, not least because of the secrecy. And as I say, we are Democrats, and it is widely known that British people support democratic values, but the monarchy clearly stands against those values, not only being undemocratic, but anti-democratic, as its values that it stands on are to do with medieval ideas of divine right and people being born into positions of status and class, which have no place in a democratic society in 2022.
All right. Thank you, Graham Smith. And Philip Blond, you're on the other side of this. So why are you a yes on Long Live the British Monarchy?
I suppose I'm a yes because I think a democracy needs something else besides democracy in order to function well. And I think the monarchy represents the pole of the one, that is the hierarchical pole in any human society. And I think that if you actually look at human beings, the principle of the one is ineliminable. You know, the only difference between a supposedly democratic society and the constitutional monarchies, democrats elect their monarchs. Every human society in history has been governed by a quasi-monarchical figure, and that is what the president is, that's what the prime minister is. Republics create monarchs. Constitutional monarchies have monarchs to restrain republics. So I think the idea that somehow a pure democracy eliminates kind of monarchical or hierarchical rule is for the birds, I'm afraid. It's simply not true. And moreover, a society that doesn't have a hierarchical pole, that doesn't decide on which values it privileges over others, what are its foundational values, is a society that polarizes very quickly. Republics are more unstable because they lack the ability to foster consensus and to create the condition for common values. What monarchs do is they, in a constitutional settlement, is they embody common values, and they prevent partisan values from capturing the highest station in the land. And so far from monarchy, in some sense, undermining democracy, monarchy preserves it and extends it. And it does this in multiple ways. As I alluded to earlier, it first of all prevents politicians from assuming totalitarian control, if I can put it like that, of the political or social sphere. It reminds politicians that they don't occupy the highest space in the land, and that they too are servants. Moreover, in a constitutional monarchy, the monarch is the state of the role is to foster consensus. And if you look at the legacy of Elizabeth, the global consensus that she helped to foster and generate is unprecedented. I can't think of any other person in the world, even including the papacy, who could command the level of global respect and affection, where not just Commonwealth countries declared mourning, but Cuba as well, and Brazil, official days of mourning. So I think that what we're actually seeing is that in a world where we're rapidly polarizing into deeply aggressive opposing camps, and America being a prime example of this, what actually republics and democracy misses is somebody who can foster consensus in hugely divided societies. there's ample history to show the ways in which monarchs have helped to prevent kind of capture or overthrow of democratic institutions. And because they embody a good beyond politics, they can actually limit or constrain politics and prevent it from becoming totalitarian or dangerous. And what I think we're seeing with the British monarchy is clearly the good that people see.
Okay. So, Graham, I want to bring this back to you. And I understand, Graham, that the thrust of your argument is that a non-elected individual with a hereditary position, not directly answerable to the public, is in itself an affront to our notions of democracy. And it's certainly one I think will resonate with most of an American audience. But before we dive into your part of the argument, I would just like you to stay with the point that Philip is making, that a monarch can be a stabilizing, unifying kind of ballast for a political system, especially for republics, and that in fact, the British monarchy has served that role. Do you see any merit to that case that Philip is making?
No, and with the greatest respect to Philip, he speaks in these grand theoretical terms, and the theory that he espouses has no bearing on the reality of monarchy at all. I mean, the notion that monarchs defend democracies from totalitarianism is simply untrue, and it is one of the most pernicious myths about the monarchy. The idea that the monarch somehow restrains our politicians or holds power away from them. Now, you know, the Greek monarchs of the 1920s and 30s and 40s colluded with fascist and military regimes. The king of Italy colluded with Mussolini and was on the throne throughout his fascist government. The Greek king in the 1960s then was absolutely useless in the face of another military coup. The Thai king, the last Thai king, not the current one, was on the throne for a very long time, and throughout a history in which there are multiple military and civilian coups and dictatorships, the current Thai king, and this is a constitutional monarchy in law, the current Thai king is absolutely in bed with the military dictatorship, and the list goes on.
More from Intelligence Squared US when we return. Welcome back to Intelligence Squared US. Let's get back to our debate.
Look, I think that the institutions themselves require what one might call a thick account of them. But, you know, just as Graham posits the compromise of kings, you have the attempted 23F coup in Spain in 1981. The Thai king in 1981 and 1985 did prove decisive, as was the governor general in Granada in 1983. So what you have are counterexamples, and what we're trying to cast out here is the type of role that a king can perform. Now, obviously, both kings and political cultures can fail that high watermark, but that isn't an argument against the existence of that.
That is the normal feature of monarchy, is their purpose is to defend their institution, and they have historically failed. I mean, there's a reason why there are so few left. And those that have stood have utterly failed when they have been challenged by authoritarian regimes. Now, in terms of the British monarchy, the idea that the British monarch can defend us against politicians is complete fallacy. The British monarch is utterly powerless, has no discretion, and will only do what the Prime Minister tells him to do. Now, the Queen acquiesced to a prorogation of Parliament, in 2019, which was then judged to be unconstitutional. Everybody blamed Boris Johnson for instructing the Queen to prorogue Parliament. No one pointed out that the Queen did nothing about questioning whether that prorogation was legitimate or constitutional at all. And she was never going to do that because her position is to do what she's told, even when what she's told to do is unconstitutional.
I just want to give Philip a chance to respond to some of the points you're making, because you're making several there. Go ahead.
I think Graham's got a very narrow and poor view of British history. Throughout British history, what we see are examples of the king siding with, for instance, the peasantry. If you go into the House of Parliament, you'll see something called the Star Chamber, which was convened by the monarch to stop the rapacious capture of common land by the aristocracy, and the peasantry and the king were allied, and often peasants in medieval and early modern periods got far greater justice in the royal courts than they did in the manorial courts. So the king has always, in the British settlement, been allied with the notion of justice. And indeed, if you look at the colonial expansion of Britain, countless times you have the British monarch writing to the colonists saying, in America, you can see the letters from King Charles saying to the colonists that the natives are Indians, are my citizens as well, treat them well. And you see this replicated throughout British history in Rhodesia, where Cecil Rhodes invaded Matabele land, in Australia, that the express royal claims were made that the natives were also subject of the monarch. So you have throughout British history, the monarchs trying and in some cases succeeding to exercise power for the general good.
I find it quite extraordinary that it is argued a positive that a monarch in England might assert that that people in indigenous cultures in America are subject to their authority. That is not a good thing. Now, the notion that the monarchs are on the side of the little people, if you like, is perverse. I mean, they have used violence and torture and imprisonment for centuries to impose their power. And since James I, they were, right the way through to when the slavery was abolished, they were very active participants in the slave trade and made a lot of money from it, including the future King William standing in the Lords and arguing against its abolition. But, you know, the debate now isn't about what kings might have done in 1500 and something. It's about what the monarchy does now. And now, as a democracy, we have a head of state who only does what the head of government tells them to do, and therefore it is we lack any checks and balances.
All right. Let me jump in and take that point to you, Philip. I want to bring to you the point that Graham is making, that the British monarchs in contemporary British monarchs don't really have a great deal of impact on the democratic process, because they don't have a great deal of authority to intervene. In fact, Prince now King Charles has had to say publicly that he's going to kind of step back from a role he enjoyed taking for the last 40, 50 years of commenting on public and trying to influence policy in certain areas like climate change, et cetera. And now that he's king, he has to kind of shut up. And so it seems to me that may go to Graham's point that the monarchs don't have much authority to exert influence in a positive way.
Yeah, well, I think here I in part agree with Graham. I would give the monarchs much more power. They're far more popular than politicians. They, you know, in certain ways enjoy, you know, 80 to 85% support. Graham's belief that they don't serve the little people isn't an opinion shared by the little people. It's an elite bourgeois opinion by people who are convinced of kind of one unreflective form of ideology, I think. And what I would like to, Charles's opinion on the environment, etc., have been light years ahead of others. And I would like to see him taking a much stronger role. And in the sense of the type of power that the monarch authorizes or uses, it's quite hard to tell, because you have to think about what politicians can do and what they can't do. So you have to prove a negative. So you have to kind of articulate what aspect of the monarchy, kind of how it shapes the whole conduct and discourse of the body politic. And I think that it civilizes the body politic. It prevents the rise of very extreme forms of polarization that you can and do see in republics. If you think of how successfully Queen Elizabeth fought against racism to integrate the Commonwealth countries of Africa within the Commonwealth when she came to the throne, there were seven. There's now well over 55. Some of them not even in the Commonwealth. So you have a sense that what monarchs do is they orchestrate, if they do their job well, and you can always have bad monarchs, is that they orchestrate a form of behavior and a context that helps preserve civilization. And I think...
No, they don't. I mean, there's no...
can't grasp the big arguments others can.
Okay, I want to let Graham jump in on that point.
I mean, the things that Philip is saying, you know, it's a lot of theory, but it doesn't reflect the reality. I mean, the idea that the Queen was fighting racism when she lobbied in the 60s and 70s, as governments were introducing laws to protect people from race discrimination in the workplace, she successfully lobbied to have herself and the royal household excluded from that legislation. And, you know, the Commonwealth, you know, as we've seen recently, people are getting very angry about slavery, reparations, and about the history of colonialism. And a lot of that anger is directed at the monarchy and at the royals themselves. So this wider notion of the monarch somehow influences our body politic, again, it just doesn't stack up. There's no evidence of this. And, you know, we are as prone as any other country to extremism, and we've had plenty of that sort of polarization in recent years. So is that a failure of the monarchy? No, it's just the reality of the society that we live in. But the monarchy fails us on many other accounts. Now, you know, we have to look at the real evidence and not just make sort of generalized claims saying republics are less stable. No, they're not. I mean, democracies and democratic republics are more stable. And if we look at in Germany, for example, which has a very strong motivation to remain democratic and stable and to see off extremists, is a federal republic. If you look at places like Iceland and Ireland and Finland and, you know, Austria and Portugal and all these places, they have elected heads of state, whether directly or indirectly. They have elected parliaments, and they are stable and successful democracies.
So, Graham, what do you make of the fact, though, that there are other democracies in Western Europe, Denmark and Norway, the Netherlands, have royal families and are absolutely qualify as stable democracies, and in you know, the Queen of Denmark is enormously popular, and the monarchy is enormously popular there, and not seen as a challenge to the basic kind of gut understanding of what it means to be a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can see that democracies have retained, some democracies, not many, have retained monarchies. I mean, in terms of the issue of stability, where countries are stable and a monarchy has managed to survive into the late 20th century, then they're more likely to survive because the pressures aren't there to get them. But, I mean, the Dutch monarchy has seen a sharp fall in support over the last few years. The British monarchy, I mean, I don't know where Philip's getting his information, but John Curtis, a very well-known pollster, in the UK, was just writing yesterday, I think, saying that the monarchy in Britain is at an all-time low in terms of popularity. Support for the monarchy has dropped sharply over the last 4 years, and support for abolition has increased. But, you know, all of these countries in Europe also have republican movements and also have serious questions about the nature of those monarchies. They're just not quite so ostentatious and so obvious in their failings. But the British monarchy is particular in its failings, not least because of the position it has in the Constitution. I mean, we have a situation which was termed about 50 years ago as an elective dictatorship because of the enormous power that is held by Downing Street, by the Prime Minister and their government. And that a lot of that comes down to the Crown and the powers of the Crown that have been transferred wholesale into the hands of the Prime Minister and their ministers. You know, and this is a significant failing. Not even getting into this, the actual failings of the institution itself. Politically and constitutionally, it does not serve us. It serves the government and the Prime Minister of the day.
So Philip, I know that the core of your argument has been the degree to which the monarchy serves the British people, but the king is now the king of head of state for 15 other nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Jamaica. To what degree does your argument for the value of the monarchy relate to the British monarch's role as head of state in those other countries? Is that critical to the point that you're making?
I think that what's happening is that as societies polarize, particularly in the West, and fragment and increasingly become conflictual, that the need for a politics and polity that speaks to the general welfare and the general good, that is free of ideology, that is free of politics, becomes ever more pressing. And I think that what you see is not just that the British monarch is celebrated in the Commonwealth, but beyond. I mean, it's remarkable the number of countries and nations that are declaring national mourning, you know, from France to Bangladesh to Brazil. All of these nations also are experiencing division. And I think that what we're seeing is that, and I think this is the greatness of Elizabeth, who, as I said, grew the Commonwealth from just 7 members to 54, incorporating most of Africa in the process, is an attempt to create a global polity that can speak to global issues at the level and scale that's required. And in that sense, Prince Charles, who anticipated many of the most dangerous problems that now confront us in terms of environmental degradation, I think has a unique opportunity. And as I said earlier, he explicitly now sees his role as a global one to serve all nations. And I think this will only increase the power and the popularity of the monarchy because it speaks to their idealism and their romance. And they have now become significant political actors. And I think Charles will be more active than his mother. And I think that that will be welcomed.
But what does it say to you that there is a Republican movement that seems to be growing in force in Australia, or that Barbados, that only last year, I think less than 10 months ago, chose no longer to have as its head of state the British monarch and wanted to go in a different direction, that the trend seems to be, I think the trend seems to be, away from involvement by other nations with having the British crown as head of state?
It depends where you put your line on the graph, doesn't it? Because you'd have trouble saying that now. And what monarchy has done is evolved into the Commonwealth. And we now have members of the Commonwealth who were never colonized by the British. Mozambique and Rwanda have joined. And I think it will expand yet further. And so I suspect that, of course, there will be Republican movements and they will wax and wane. But I think that if you went back to 1900 and you spoke about the almost global popularity of the British monarchy, people would be very surprised. In terms of the long durée, I don't think globally the British monarchy has ever exercised such power, symbolic and cultural power, as they do now. And I think that that has changed our ask of the monarch, and we now will want them to operate at this level and to shape the questions that we need to address at this global level. And they are becoming almost the only global figures outside of religious figures that can speak to the general interest. So I think it looks very positive.
What you're saying does not reflect reality. Now, I mean, I've just been reading a book by Philip Murphy, who's one of the leading experts on analysing the Commonwealth. And his general conclusion is that as an institution, it's largely pointless. It doesn't really do an awful lot. And, I mean, the Commonwealth, which now has 56 nations, it is, most of those nations are republics. It, despite its claims to support values like democracy and human rights, it seems quite happy to make room for dictators and for people who, with awful human rights records. And it is just allowed Gabon, I think it was, to join the Commonwealth, which has an awful record on these things. Something like more than 90% of the population of the Commonwealth live in republics. The Commonwealth was not created by a monarch. It hasn't been grown by the monarch. It hasn't been sustained by the monarch. It is a result of intergovernmental decisions that were influenced by a host of different issues, not least the sweeping independence movements of the 50s and 60s, the post-war situation that Britain found itself in, and so on. But where it stands now is an institution that has very little relevance beyond its sporting events that they hold every 4 years.
I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared US. We'll hear more from our debaters right after this. Welcome back to Intelligence Squared US. I'm John Donvan. Let's get back to our debate. Graham, Brian mentioned with some degree of wonder the fact that the French are publicly mourning the Queen, and that Brazil issued a statement and that Cuba issued a statement. Certainly here in the United States, the television coverage has been nonstop. And I can tell you that no other royal period of grieving or funeral will ever get the coverage that we're seeing for the Queen. And I want to ask you about that, about the point that I think that Brian really is making, is that the Queen has a positive reputation globally, and that as the embodiment of the monarchy, that comes to the institution as well. And you know, we all know as Americans that the British royal family is actually a great tourist attraction, and that it tells a positive story that that draws a lot of positive attention. And I would like you to take that on and tell us what's going on with all of that. What is that about?
Well, in terms of countries declaring mourning periods and so on, you know, that is about diplomacy on the whole, and it is about the fact that the Queen, particularly, is someone who's been around a very long time, who people don't really know, and therefore project all sorts of things onto her and believe all sorts of things about the sort of person she is, and she has become a figure who sort of has become more myth than reality, if you like. And so, you know, she does loom large in people's imaginations. But, you know, that is what part of the problem that the monarchy now faces, because for most people, the Queen was the monarchy, and the monarchy was the Queen. That does not transfer to Charles, you know, and that won't happen when Charles dies. You know, so, but the... Beyond that, you know, it isn't true that the monarchy is good for tourism. That simply isn't the case. There is no evidence for that whatsoever. We've done the research. We've spoken to Visit Britain, the leading tourist agency in the country. It makes absolutely no difference to our economy whatsoever. Yes, it the monarchy attracts media attention. That is not global in, you know, it certainly within the English-speaking language, countries, it gets a lot of attention, and certainly to some extent elsewhere, but it isn't the global phenomenon that Philip seems to think it is. So these things are overplayed and overstated quite widely, and, you know, to whatever extent they are overplayed and overstated, that's with the Queen. That is not going to be replicated with Charles, who people don't know that well and have all sorts of good reasons not to respect or to like or to look up to.
And Philip, do you think that King Charles may prove a liability compared to his mother?
No, I don't. I just enjoying Graham's relentlessly pessimistic and negative view that I think stands counter to everybody's intuitions and reality itself. I think that the reason why republics joined the Commonwealth with the titular head of state as the monarch is because they see the deficiencies, I think, in their own polity. And the hope is that the Commonwealth, over time, will exercise the type of transformation that we want and that people
That's
need.
That's not true, Philip. You're just saying things which are not born in reality.
Graham just is so desperate to impugn the monarchs that he's saying clearly contradictory things. You know, the monarch's been the Queen Elizabeth was around for a long time, therefore people don't know her well. I think it's precisely because the Queen was around for a long time and she exercised a different type of diplomacy, which is acknowledged by all the politicians who would know, but speaks to kind of her power and the type of shaping that she was trying to do. And I think it's very clear that the Queen was instrumental in growing the Commonwealth. Nobody who's involved with the Commonwealth would think otherwise. So I think that on the positive side of the copybook, if you will, is very strong and very evident, and the popular support is there. I suspect Charles will be more successful than people imagine, quite simply because he will be an idealistic and romantic non-partisan voice for what most people think. And I think he will help to restore the notion of consensus to other polities where it's sadly absent.
Graham, imagine for me, for all of us, what Britain will look like without a monarchy.
Well, you know, what the proposition is, which has been proven to work many times elsewhere, is a parliamentary democracy, which is stronger and more democratic and more accountable, where you still have a prime minister, you still have two houses of parliament, or you would get rid of the House of Lords, which is a whole other farce, and you would have a fully elected parliament in which the people can be properly represented, and you would have a constitution which limits the power of parliament and government, and you would have an elected head of state who would not be running the government or making political decisions, but would play that symbolic role.
What would you call that head of state? Would you have a president?
Yes, president. I mean, this is the common terminology. I mean, if you see the presidents of Ireland, for example, they have been exemplary. The Michael D. Higgins is a fantastic head of state. Mary McAleese and Mary Robinson before him were both hugely popular, and their poll ratings are right up there alongside the Queen's. Charles's, of course, is far lower than the Queen's, as we've seen just today. Presidents of Iceland have been exceptional as well. Vigdis Finnbogadottir, the first woman ever to be elected a head of state in the world in 1980, enjoyed a long period in office in Iceland. We also have excellent heads of state in Germany and Finland and elsewhere. And, you know, these people are elected. They serve a limited term, usually a limit of two terms, but their term lengths can vary from 4 to 7 years. And they have some limited constitutional power, so they can actually act as a check and balance to guard the constitution and to defend the country against politicians who may wish to breach the constitution.
Philip, I'd like to ask you the same question. What would Britain be without a monarchy?
It would be denuded of its specific gift to the world, which is, I think, as George Orwell put it, a shared and embodied notion of common decency. It would be stripped of the ability to foster consensus and so secure the democratic polity and extend equity to all. We know that we're in a democratic recession. Democracies are receding across the globe. Democracy by itself is not enough to sustain democracy. And one of the reasons is that there's no figurehead for the formulation of a common good. There's no figurehead in these polities that can actually help foster the type of communal reverence and enjoyment and celebration that a monarch can. And monarchs, I think, in a constitutional settlement, demonstrate that they can help secure democracy against the partisan forces. Stripping the monarchy away from Britain would be like stripping one of the great sort of lights of the democratic world, a key part of what has defended that democratic world. It will make Britain a more dangerous politics and a more dangerous polity, because nothing is more dangerous than a democracy without direction from a more shared communal sense of values, as contemporary America makes explicitly clear.
Britain is one of the most unequal societies in the democratic world. We have one of the most dysfunctional and centralized constitutions in the world, which gives us one of the most powerful and unchecked governments in the world. The idea that democracy is somehow sliding backwards because there aren't monarchs in the round around is utterly bizarre, and it just isn't again attached any at all to reality. You know, the monarchy is the institution that that centralizes power, that enables the politicians to do whatever they like with very few checks and balances in place. And the monarchy itself, as an institution, you know, the idea that it is somehow noble and gifted or equitable or anything like that, I mean, this is an institution that demands secrecy, deference. It demands public money to be spent on themselves. It protects someone like Prince Andrew, who is facing serious accusations. It allows someone like Charles to receive huge bags of you know, 3 million euros in cash from someone who has allegedly had connections with Al-Qaeda. It protects him from proper police investigation when there is evidence that he was trading honors for donations. You know, this is not a good institution of good people. And we can all dream up fantasies about, you know, some benign monarch guiding us all as if we're all children needing guiding. But the people and cultures and politics flourishes when we are free to make our own decisions, stand on our own two feet, and to control our own institutions and have those institutions represent the values which we actually believe in, and not to be patronized by this weird feudal institution which is only there to support power of the few.
Graham, did you have a time in your life, maybe childhood or later, when you were supportive of the monarchy and excited by them? And did you have a kind of, you know, Saul on the road to Damascus conversion point?
No, I've always looked at it and thought it's absurd. I mean, I took an interest in politics as a teenager, and I always thought it was absurd then. I mean, on a very basic level, I remember just thinking, well, you know, why would we do that when we can just allow people to choose someone? And the older I got, I looked at the institution, I looked at what other people do. I mean, if you look at what we've just gone through with the accession, where Charles just, without any consent, without any discussion or debate, he just takes the job for no reason. He's not qualified for it. He, you know, this idea that he's unifying or non-partisan. I mean, his environmentalism is built on a mountain of hypocrisy and eccentric ideas. He just took that role, believing that he was owed it because his mother had it. You look back to the last presidential election in Ireland in 2011, they had a number of candidates. More than one of them was eminently suitable to be president. The Irish people had an opportunity to discuss what sort of country they were and how they wanted that represented.
So let me break in. You're saying that King Charles was undeserving, that this was a gross act of nepotism, if anything. And I want to take that back to Philip, the notion that because it's hereditary, King Charles had to basically do nothing but keep breathing to get this role, and that he doesn't actually deserve it. I don't know how widespread an opinion that is in the UK, but I'd like you to take on the question, Philip.
Yeah, I mean, Graham has a touching faith in empty formalism, when the reality is that democracy, since indexes, the Bertelsmann Transformation Index has shown the worst results this last year for democracy. Democracies are failing across the globe. And they normally fail because of a fragmentation, internal values, or actual civil war where people can't foster common goods, and then one side or the other takes over and essentially suspends the other side and suspends democracy. Why I think the hereditary principle is also a legitimate principle. I mean, let's try and apply this to children. Why should children be looked after by their parents if it's just an accident of birth? Let's take children from their parents and ensure equity of treatment in special children's camps. And that, of course, was the ideology of communism.
I mean, this is getting into weird realms now, Philip. I mean,
but I think what Graham is saying is that being the Queen's son does not qualify. It certifies him for the role, but does not qualify him for the role of leadership.
Well, I think it does qualify him, because what we have is a different account of formation and performance. What we have is the idea that there is a station you will occupy, and that station disciplines and shapes people such that they can perform their duties. And what's interesting is, so powerful is that station, that generally speaking, we've been very lucky with our monarchs. And it's just like with our unwritten constitution. What's a written constitution doesn't guarantee you anything. In fact, written constitutions normally don't work. They can be subverted. So you weren't able in America, I'm not taking a position on this, to kind of remove Donald Trump. But in Britain's unwritten constitution, they were able to remove Boris Johnson. Far more effective than the formal is the informal, which is based upon character, tradition, and notions of how one ought to behave. And I think that being shaped by a position is also a form of legitimacy. And if we abandon that, what we essentially abandon is the idea that that power, people who inherit wealth, position, which is what dictates most outcomes now, are actually free of any obligations or honor or culture for how they ought to behave. And one of the reasons that inequality has become so rampant in our societies is we've freed the wealthy from any obligations of honor that come from their station as being wealthy. What we really should do is expand the notion that adheres to the hereditary principle to other outcomes that also derive from a similar principle, like inherited wealth, and reintroduce the notion of responsibility and duty. And I think that's what people responded to Queen Elizabeth so strongly for, was her notion of service. And actually, the notion of service is incumbent upon many positions in our society, the army and the armed services being but one example. And this does wonders for human beings. So the very last thing we want to do is remove the idea that your station can shape you.
All right. Not surprisingly, the two of you disagree up to the end, but I want to thank you both for taking part in the conversation and doing so respectfully and civilly. So Philip Blond and Graham Smith, thank you so much for joining us at Intelligence Squared.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the conversation you just heard, everybody, perfectly captures why we do this. You know that the way that discourse is taking place in our culture these days is pretty broken. And that's why it's so unusual, but also refreshing to hear two people who disagree actually be able to have a rational and civil conversation that sheds light. And we know from so many of you, that's exactly why you listen to our debates. And why I would like to remind you that as you turn to us for that, we turn to you for support. We're a nonprofit, and it's contributions from listeners like you that keep us going. So please consider sending us a buck or two or 10 or 50, whatever works. And that'll give you a stake in what we're doing here every week. And it means we'll be here every week, this week, next week, and beyond. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I'm John Donvan, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Intelligence Squared, made possible by a generous grant from the Laura and Gary Lauder Venture Philanthropy Fund. As a nonprofit, our work to combat extreme polarization through civil and respectful debate is generously funded by listeners like you, the Rosenkrantz Foundation, and friends of Intelligence Squared. Robert Rosenkrantz is our chairman, Clea Connor is CEO, David Ariosto is head of editorial, Julia Melfi, Shea O'Mara, and Marlette Sandoval are our producers. Damon Whittemore is our radio producer, and I'm your host, John Donvan. We'll see you next time.